We want to consider two things tonight in the chapter that was read. It's a long chapter, and I don't want us to get lost in all the details. But the two matters are, first of all, Jephthah, the man that God has chosen to lead his people against the enemy, who are the Ammonites. I'll say that again, the Ammonites. And then we will look at the vow that Jephthah makes. So the first point is from verse 12 down to verse 28, where Jephthah seeks a peaceful means to bring a negotiation about with the Ammonites. And obviously this didn't work, because from verse 29 they have to go into battle. Now, does anybody remember what's the one theme in these chapters with Jephthah? The one thing that we've been considering. We considered it last time, and we're definitely going to consider it this evening. Our words. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And what these chapters impress upon us is the need to be true, that we mean what we say and say what we mean. So this comes out in the negotiations between Jephthah and the Ammonites. It's a very relevant piece to our situation today. There's fake news today. People propagate all sorts of half-truths, so you don't longer know what is true or not. And there is cancel culture, where we try to change our history. And this is what the children of Ammon try to do with Jephthah. If we can have the map up on the screen, I'm going to be a geography teacher for a bit. That's why I've got this stick here. It's not for another reason. If we were in Andhra Pradesh now, the deacons would have sticks like this on a hot and sultry evening. If they saw anybody nodding off, they would prod them with the stick. But if you can see that map, the Ammonites lived on the east side of the Jordan, beyond the land of Edom and Moab, and where the tribe of Reuben is. That's the red-orange coloured block. And they say this land that now belongs to the tribe of Reuben, between the Arnon and the Jabbok rivers — it's not that big a parcel of land, is it? — they say that belongs to us. We want to go to war with you if you won't give it back to us. So that's their fake news. They're trying to twist history. And I'm not going to refer to the verses, but in our reading, we had Jephthah putting the facts straight with them. And what Jephthah says, when the children of Israel came out of Egypt — could we have it zoomed a bit, please, Tim? Thank you. They came to the land of Edom and the land of Moab, and they asked permission of the kings of both if they could travel through their respective countries. And both those kings denied them permission. So in our reading, Jephthah recounted the true history, that the children of Israel went around. And then when they came to the Arnon River, they asked the king of the Amorites — not the Ammonites, the Amorites — who owned that piece of land, the orange-red piece of land, they asked him permission to travel through. And he didn't just refuse, he went to war with them. And so the children of Israel were forced to fight the Amorites. And they won, and so God then gave them that parcel of land between the rivers Arnon and Jabbok. And for 300 years, the tribe of Reuben dwelt there. And now the Ammonites are twisting the historical facts by saying it belongs to us. And Jephthah says, oh no, you need to get your history straight. It doesn't belong to you. For 300 years, the Reubenites have been living there. And why didn't you take it? You've had 300 years to do that. I remember hearing about a debate that took place, and somebody was stopping the other person by saying to them, the facts are getting in the way. The facts are getting in the way. Facts are stubborn things, aren't they? And Jephthah here, all he does is recount the facts, the historical facts. And then he goes on to say something else. It's a difficult verse. Verse 24, will you not possess whatever Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? So whatever the Lord our God takes possession of before us, we will possess. Doesn't that give the impression that Jephthah is saying to the Ammonites, Chemosh, your God, has given you your land, you serve him, and the Lord Jehovah has given us our land, and we will serve him. Well, Jephthah isn't saying here that Chemosh is a true and a living God. He's just using the arguments. You serve your God and the land that he's given you, but actually it's not Chemosh that's given you that land, but it's the true and the living God. Acts chapter 17, Paul preaching in Athens, he put it like this, God hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed, and this is it, and the bounds of their habitation. What does that mean? He's set our boundaries. He has set the lines, if you like. When the psalmist says, our lines are fallen unto us in pleasant places, the word lines there means the set boundaries of the allocations of the land to the tribes of the children of Israel. And what the Ammonites are doing here, because they're discontent, they're trying to twist history and make a claim, a false claim, to the land. I find it interesting that there's only one letter that's different between the Ammonites, who say they possess that land, and the Amorites, who originally possessed that land. Isn't fake news sometimes so subtle? It can be the difference of one letter, even. We need to have our wits about us, don't we? We need to ask the God of Jephthah for wisdom. Our Jephthah, Jesus Christ, as we noticed last time, is wisdom incarnate. He is the truth. And don't we need to learn? It's a very hard lesson to learn. But Paul was in this school, and we are in this school, and Paul was able to write, and he was writing from house arrest, so I can listen to him. I have learnt in whatsoever state I am to be content therein. Wasn't it discontent that drove the Ammonites to want that extra territory that wasn't theirs? I'm reading about the Second World War at the moment. Wasn't it greed and discontent on the part of certain nations that made them want to expand their territory? Is it not discontent that causes conflict, not just between countries, but within families, in the workplace, a powerful character wanting to reach the top at the expense of others, and even in churches? It's a horrible thing, isn't it? Discontent. And in the end, what we've got to learn from this, I know it's a complicated chapter, but are we content with our lot? Can we say with the psalmist that the lines are fallen unto us in pleasant places? We had a profitable discussion, I think, in church council last night, a fellowship meeting here in the church, and we were discussing what we've learnt during lockdown. And one member of council mentioned how he'd learnt to count his many blessings. Haven't you found that to be the case? Even the small things that we would have taken for granted before have now become more precious. Count your many blessings. This is the antidote to discontent. Name them one by one. It's a battle of the mind, isn't it? Instead of twisting the facts, we rehearse the facts. Name them one by one, and it will surprise you what the Lord has done. Look at the way Jephthah puts it. Verse 27. This is how he ends the debate. I like this. Verse 27, therefore I have not sinned against you, he says to the Ammonites, but you wronged me by fighting against me. May the Lord, the judge, render judgment this day between the children of Israel and the people of Ammon. May the Lord judge. God knows. That's all we can say in the end, you know. We were going to try and sing this hymn, but we haven't got it in our database. Maybe you're familiar with it. It's a hard lesson to learn in the school of Christ. Thy way, not mine, O Lord. However dark it be, lead me by thine own hand. Choose the path for me. And I dare not choose my lot. I would not, if I might. Can you say this? Choose thou for me, my God, so shall I walk aright. Not mine the choice, in things or great or small. Be thou my guide, my strength, my wisdom, and my all. And in days when there is so much confusion with fake news and cancel culture, don't we just need to ask God for much wisdom? Now then, let's hurry on to the second matter in this chapter, which is the vow that Jephthah takes. I've been trying to avoid it, all these Bible studies, but we have to deal with it. Diplomatic means didn't work. So what happens? The children of Israel have to fight against the Ammonites. And notice how God equips his servants. Verse 29, as we've been reading several times in the book of Judges, then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah. And we don't have much details of the battle. That's interesting. Up till now, usually you've had much written on the battle. But here, the emphasis is not on the battle, but on the vow, or rash vow, as we would call it, that Jephthah makes before the battle. Let me read the vow. Verse 30, and Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, that is, if you give me victory, then it will be that whatever, notice, not whoever, whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me, when I come back in peace from the people of Ammon, that I will offer it up to the Lord as a burnt offering. And of course, Jephthah wins the battle and he comes back home, and the first person that comes out of the doors of the house to meet him is his daughter. Not just his daughter, but his only child. Verse 34. And as if we didn't get the message, besides her, he had neither son nor daughters. Now, just a technical note here. There are some issues, and this is one of them, where good Christians take different views. Now, we must be able to approach this in that spirit. There are actually many issues that are not gospel issues, and we must be prepared to agree to disagree with people who are much more able and much more spiritual than we are. So obviously the two schools of thought here are that Jephthah, first of all, did not offer his daughter as a burnt offering. That couldn't be the case. If Jephthah is mentioned in Hebrews 11 as one of the great heroes of the faith, how can somebody who kills his own daughter be commended by God? Also, the people who take this view would say, how can God, who is a God of truth and of justice, condone such behavior? The false gods did have such sacrifices, but the God of Israel, how would he ever condone such an action? And then, there isn't any mention of Jephthah killing her. There is mention of one thing several times. What is it? When the daughter comes out and hears about what her father has done, what does she want? She says to him, you must do what you've said to the Lord you would do. You've made a promise to the Lord. You can't go back on your word. But what favor does she ask of him? Verse 37. Nobody's going to speak out. Let this thing be done for me. Let me alone for 2 months that I may go and wander on the mountains and bewail my virginity, my friends and I. So the people who hold the view that Jephthah did not put to death his daughter, they would say that he offered her up to serve the Lord in his tabernacle and that she could not marry for the rest of her days, that she became a virgin. And that is why she needs 2 months before he offers her to just lament the fact that she's not going to be married. Now, maybe you take that view, and there's something to be said for it, but I'm not convinced, I'm afraid. To begin with, the women who did serve the Lord in the tabernacle were not necessarily virgins. So why is she kind of lamenting the fact that she's never going to get married? The next point, and Matthew Henry makes this point, why did she want 2 months to mourn the fact that she was never going to be married? Wasn't she going to have the rest of her life to do that? Let me read Matthew Henry here, because he's very helpful. Had she only been confined to a single life, she needed not to have had the 2 months to bewail it in. She had a whole life before her to do that, nor needed she to take such a sad leave of her companions. And that's another thing. After this sacrifice, we're told that it became a custom in Israel that the daughters of Israel, verse 40, went 4 days each year to grieve for the daughter of Jephthah. Why would they do that if he offered her to serve the Lord? It doesn't make sense, does it? It would have been a matter of rejoicing, not a matter of bewailing. And then, of course, the word burnt offering in verse 31. Yes, Jephthah says, whatever comes out of the door of my house shall surely be the Lord's. That would seem to indicate he's offering it to the Lord. But then the word he uses, burnt offering, I will offer it up as a burnt offering. The word there means holocaust. Something completely burnt. I think the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, uses the word holocaust to describe that sacrifice. And also the emphasis on this being his only child. His only child. Isn't there an echo there of some other sacrifice? Well, the sacrifice didn't take place. Can anybody remember? where an only child was supposed to be sacrificed. Isaac, Isaac. And when Abraham was about to thrust the knife into Isaac, what happened? A voice came from heaven saying to him, "Hold your hand. I have provided a sacrifice instead." And we know that points to the Lamb of God, the only Son of God. But do you notice what happens here? There is no voice from heaven. Heaven is silent here. And to me, that makes it most poignant. And so it's not as if God is condoning what Jephthah is doing here. It's as if God is silent. We can't play with God. We can't make promises to God and then go back on our word. It was a strange time, wasn't it? It was an immoral time. And as we've been going through the book, the immorality has got worse and worse. And even the men that God has raised latterly have been very flawed. It'll get worse. Samson is even more flawed. And so what we mustn't do is try to sanitize them. We can't do that. I think Dale Ralph Davis, who does take this view that Jephthah actually offered his daughter as a burnt offering, he puts it very well. It's as if the writer wants to swallow up victory and sorrow, almost as if he disposes of the Ammonites because he's focusing on what Jephthah's vow will bring. The day will be far more bitter for the victor than for the vanquished. The day will be far more bitter for Jephthah, who had a victory, than even for the Ammonites who were defeated. And you know what makes it more tragic? Jephthah need never have made the vow in the first place. What do we read in verse 29? "Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah." Before he made the vow, why did he ever have to make the vow? I don't think Jephthah expected his daughter, incidentally, to come out first. I'm not saying here that Jephthah intended to offer his daughter as a burnt sacrifice. He was a man of God, and that would have been reprehensible to him. But what we've got to understand is the reaction of Jephthah when he realized that the first one that did come out of his house was his daughter. Look at what he did. Verse 35, "And it came to pass when he saw her that he tore his clothes and said, 'Alas, my daughter, alas, you have brought me very low. You are among those who trouble me.'" He was afflicted. He was disturbed even, just as we are probably disturbed if this is true, that he actually offered her as a burnt sacrifice. But isn't it more poignant that he didn't really need to do it? The Spirit had already equipped him. I don't know if I'm going too far here, but I think the commentators are right who say that Jephthah took a rash vow. He spoke without thinking. I think it's right to go as far as to say Jephthah was in effect using this vow as a bargaining tool with God. And that's something we must never do. Now, is somebody going to go away from here tonight thinking that we should never ever make vows? Not at all. It's a very lovely thing to make promises to the Lord. One of the most beautiful vows in the Old Testament is that of Hannah. Beautiful. But Hannah wasn't bargaining with God. It was flowing from a heart that was filled with thankfulness. And I think that's the key here. We can't play with God. We've got to watch our words. I think Jephthah was expecting, because if you've ever been to houses in the Middle East, often they will have courtyards and there'll be animals roaming around in the courtyard. In terms of probability, whatever came first out of his house, he was expecting it to be an animal. I don't think he was expecting it to be his only daughter. I don't think he was. It shocked him. And then he was in a dilemma. I've promised God. Not just a promise, but a vow. I vowed to the Lord. And I can't go back. They're strange times, aren't they? Incidentally, it is the common Reformed evangelical view now that Jephthah did sacrifice his daughter, if that helps. So if you look at some of the best study Bibles, as well as commentaries, they will tend to go for this view. And that doesn't make it any easier. It doesn't mean that God condones it. There's silence. It's just reported. This is how bad things have got. This is how confusing things are. Even a man like Jephthah, who is trying to be a man who keeps his word, even he has got himself into a mess. What about us? What about us? Let me end by just quoting a few verses. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 22. 1 Samuel 15. 22. I don't want us to not take vows. There are special times when it is the right thing to do. All I'm saying is don't play with God. Don't rush in. Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams." It's not about bargaining with God. It's about an obedient heart that just wants to serve God. And then one of my favorite verses, Psalm 51. Psalm 51. Towards the end of the psalm. Verse 15, O Lord, open my lips. Notice, words. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth shall, what? Not make rash vows, not twist the facts of history. My mouth shall show forth your praise, for you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. A broken and a contrite heart, these, O God, you will not despise. And I think by the end of this chapter, even Jephthah was beginning to come to that place. May we tonight come with our broken, contrite hearts and spirits to a God who has sacrificed his only Son so that we can have access into his very presence. And let us also count our many blessings. Let us thank God for all the good things. He's not a harsh God. It's the silence in this chapter that we need to notice. Silence sometimes speaks louder than words.